I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Cities are like elephants. They get more economical with size. That's the conclusion of Dr. Jeffrey West, president of the Santa Fe Institute. Together with ecologist Jim Brown at the University of New Mexico, he's producing important new insights on how cities grow, why they fade, and what we can do about it. Dr. Jeffrey West is our guest today on Smart City. Also with us is Denise Nunez to talk about her recent experiences as a volunteer in New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward. That's today on Smart City, but first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. There aren't a lot of theoretical physicists who have helped solve an old puzzle in biology, but then not a lot of theoretical physicists are Jeffrey West. As president of the Santa Fe Institute, Dr. West brings one of the research community's most versatile minds to bear on some of nature's most complex questions. His current research is fascinating. Working with ecologist Jim Brown at the University of New Mexico, he studied the relationship between the average weight of a species of mammal and such variables as blood pressure or metabolic rate, and found that the larger the animal, the more efficient it is. Such formulas are remarkably precise, and the researchers are trying to see if similar relationships apply for social organizations such as cities and companies. Working with ecologist Jim Brown, you've studied the relationship between the average weight of a species of mammal and variables such as blood pressure and metabolic rate. You now believe that what you learned about those relationships actually has something to teach us about cities. What did you find?
Yes. So the work in biology was pretty much focused, originally at least, on trying to understand what are referred to technically as scaling laws. That is, how do various quantities, such as the ones you mentioned, metabolic rate, blood pressure, lifespan, growth rates, how do all those change as you change the size of the animal, say from a mouse to an elephant, or a small plant to a big tree? How do all those things change? And we discovered a bunch of underlying principles to do with the way organisms in general are sustained, and this is primarily through the constraints of networks, various networks that play a central role in both supplying resources and energy to an organism, as well as dealing with waste problems and information and so forth. And it was very natural, once we had understood that theory and understood its sort of universal nature across almost the entire spectrum of biology, from intracellular levels up to ecosystems, to take the same kind of paradigm, the same kind of idea, and start to think about whether similar ideas could be applied to social organizations, and in particular cities, and asking the question, in some very general sense, are cities simply, in quotes, just a blown-up organism? Are they just sort of the continuation of biology? Is there something, or was there something new brought to the planet when human beings started to form social communities? Was that a new dynamic, and did it represent something unique beyond biology? And we attacked that in a similar way to the kinds of ways we had dealt with in biology, asking, is there some reasonably well-defined connection between all the various characteristics of a large city and that of a small city? So that was sort of the general framework and the kind of background to this work.
How did you answer your own questions? Are cities just a continuation of biology?
Well, we discovered that in many respects, they are biological. But in others, they were quite distinct and quite unique. Would you like me to say a few words about the basis of the biological, so I can talk a little bit about the cities? Would that be helpful?
Please do.
Okay, so in the case of organisms, one thing that had already been discovered before we came on the scene were a bunch of these scaling laws which told one quite precisely in many ways the way in which if you scale up, as I say, and let's take the example I talked about earlier, a mouse to an elephant, it told you how all the various characteristics of a mouse, all the physiological characteristics, the ones we already mentioned, metabolism, lifespan, therefore aging, number of diseases that it has in its lifetime, blood pressure, rates of blood flow, all various things, many of these things, how they scale with size so that you can somehow evolve an elephant from a mouse. And what we discovered were things like if you increase the size by a factor of, let's say, 10,000. So one animal is 10,000 times heavier than another. Characteristically, its metabolic rate, that is how much energy does it need to keep it alive, only increases by a factor of 1,000. So whereas you would naively think that if you increase the size by a factor of 10,000 and therefore the number of cells increases by a factor of 10,000, you would require 10,000 times the amount of energy. But in fact, you only require 1,000 times. So there's an extraordinary economy of scale as you increase size of animals. And it's in a quite well-defined way and according to these so-called scaling laws. And as I said earlier, the origin of these scaling laws is in the dynamics and geometry of the underlying networks by which animals function. And you can think of animals as basically a bundle of networks, such as respiratory systems, circulatory systems, renal systems, a bunch of bones, the informational systems of the brain, and so on. So there was an extraordinary economy of scale that one can explain in this theory. And also what was interesting was that all time scales, such as heart rates, rates of evolution, rates at which various things like oxygen diffuse across surfaces, lifespans, all of these also scaled in a systematic, well-defined way. So, for example, heart rates, if you increase the let's take the example we did of increasing the weight by a factor of 10,000. Heart rate of would decrease by a factor of 10, and indeed this is true. All of this is in agreement with data. So and lifespans would concomitantly increase by maybe a factor of roughly 10. So there were these well-defined kind of nonlinear scaling laws, which had this characteristic of an economy of scale, greater efficiency with size, and a slowing of the pace of life the bigger you are. So, and we sort of anecdotally recognize that an elephant somehow moves slower, lives longer than a mouse, which sort of scurries around and so on, or big dogs move sort of more slowly and ponderously than little dogs. So that is all explained by this theory. So it turns out that when you go to cities, and we started looking at quantities that are sort of analogous to the kinds of things that we had looked at in biology, such and we refer to those infrastructural, such as, for example, total length of all the roads in the city, or the total length of all the electrical cables, the amount of water being used, things of this nature which you can associate with infrastructure and which have very clear analogs in an organism and are also associated clearly with infrastructural kinds of networks, whether road networks, electrical networks, and so on. All of these scaled similarly to what they did for organisms, for animals, so that there was reflected in those scaling laws an economy of scale, meaning that the bigger you are, say the bigger the city you look at, the less roads are needed per capita, or the less number of gas stations are needed per capita, or the less the number, the length of electrical lines. So there was this great economy of scale being expressed in cities. So that was very interesting, and we were very pleased with that. But we had a real surprise when we looked at quantities that are much more uniquely social in character and are really associated with the more interesting and exciting aspects of what we think of when we think of cities and communities. And those were things like the number – these were just measures that we used because it was hard to get a lot of this data – the number of patents being produced in a city, the number of colleges and universities, the number of policemen, the number of the amount of taxes being paid, number of crimes being committed, and so on. Things that were really uniquely social. The thing that we discovered was something that was very, very different than we had seen in biology, where we saw this economy of scale. That is, the bigger you are, the less you need per capita. In all of these uniquely social phenomena, we found the exact opposite. The bigger you are, the more you have per capita. So the bigger the city, the more patents are being produced per capita, the more police you have per capita, the higher the wages are per capita, the more colleges there are per capita, the more what are called often super creative, sort of professional kinds of people there are per capita, the more crimes there are per capita, the more diseases there are per capita. And all of these things go along in unison. And that was – so there were two surprises. One is that there was this increase with scale, but also that they all happened – they all increased in a very similar way. So if you increased a city by a, given, by a certain size, if you just increased by, say – I don't know, a factor of 100. So you took a city, you looked at a city of 100,000 and compared it to a city of 100 times as big, meaning, what is that, 10 million. So you increase by a factor of 100, you would find that you would only need 40% of the roads increase. That is, you wouldn't have to increase – if you increase by 100, you don't have to increase – the total road surface by a factor of 100. You only have to increase it by, say, a factor of 140, 150. So you get an economy of scale there. However, you would find that you would have, instead of when you increase by 100, 200 times the number of patents being produced, 200 times the number of crimes being produced,
and
so on.
How do you explain that?
Well, let me just say, well, first – let me go back to the nature of this work. So by discovering these scaling laws, first of all, one is saying that – one is asking the question, in what way is New York a blown-up version of San Francisco, which is a blown-up version of, I don't know, Santa Fe, where I'm sitting at the moment? Now, at first, it seems sort of amazing to think that, you know, these are – that New York is a scaled-up Santa Fe. I mean, they look completely different. The size is extraordinarily different. And yet, one of the things that these scaling laws have told us, as they did in biology, where we saw that an elephant in many respects is a blown-up gorilla, which is a blown-up mouse, but in a well-defined way according to these nonlinear kind of scaling laws, so we did with cities. And underlying that, underlying these features of animals are the constraints, dynamics, geometry of networks. So we believe that the phenomena that we see in cities, which have these sort of common scaling laws that tie all of these these interesting phenomena together are related to properties of networks that really define the essence of city. The fact that these are really what cities really are, and it's sort of a no-brainer in a way, are places which have human beings interacting pairwise, typically interacting usually one-on-one, but then forming groups, various groups, and those groups themselves interact with other groups until you build up what is a city. And they interact through various artifacts, such as roads and electrical systems and computer systems and so forth, all of which are networked in, and have very general characteristics, and that these phenomena are connected with those characteristics. Now, in biology, we have understood those at some at quite detailed levels, and we have developed a mathematical, quantitative, and predictive theory for that. This work in cities is very recent. The paper that the only paper that we published came out just a couple of months ago, and this work is very much, very, very much still in progress. It's very exciting, and we have still yet to develop the kind of general theory of city that can deeply explain these in a quantitative way, so that I can answer your question with the same kind of I don't know, authority that I could if we were talking only about biology. And so what we are hoping to do with this work is indeed to develop, based on the phenomena that we have discovered, a theory of city that can be put in terms of a quantitative predictive mathematical framework. And by a theory of city, I need to clarify that a little bit. What we mean there is a theory of for the average city of a given size. So it really is talking about an average idealized city of a given size. So if you tell me a city has a population of 175,000, this theory will tell you what we expect its general characteristics to be across a whole bunch of variables ranging from the amount of taxes people pay to the amount of crime that's going on, the rate at which disease is spread, its growth rate, and so on. One of the ways in which this theory would be used is to, when you look at a specific city, to ask, why does it deviate, if it does, from the specifics of this average idealized city?
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Dr. Jeffrey West, president of the Santa Fe Institute. Let me come back, though, to clarify one thing you said. You said the bigger the city, the less infrastructure you need per capita. Now, I want to understand bigger, which equates, I assume, to weight of going back to your elephant example. Does bigger mean more people, or is there something about the way in which those people are organized across the landscape, meaning density?
Yes.
Is density the key to gaining these efficiencies, or is it simply size?
No, that's a very good question, and we struggled with this for a while, and we decided that, in fact, it was absolute population was the measure that we were going to use, and partly that was driven by two things. One was simply availability of data and the form data comes in. Mm-hmm. And typically data comes in the form of when you look at cities in terms of population rather than population density, although, of course, involved both in population and questions of population density and therefore area of city, and as well as dimensionality of city. Some cities New York, of course, the classic example being more vertical. But also are questions of definition of city. You know, what is a city? You know, where do you draw the boundary and so on? And I had to rely on my colleagues who are experts in this, urban geographers and urban economists, in terms of these questions. But one of the things that the other motivation for using population was that in organisms, we used weight or mass as the variable to denote size, and that has a direct, typically a fairly direct relationship to the number of cells in the body, if it was a multicellular organism. And number of and the cells, of course, are the for a multicellular organism, are the fundamental unit which dominates the dynamics of an organism, that is, the interaction between cells and the supply of energy and resources to cells. So it was very natural, at least as a first in the first round, to think of the analog of cells being people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we did think, you know, you could take other units. You could have taken, you know, houses or, you know, place of employment and all sorts of other things. And we decided after some discussion and looking at data that simply taking population as a measure and thinking of density, since you brought it up, as a derived quantity. And rather than the primary quantity. And that ultimately, you know, when we have a deep theory of this, it may well be that we decide that density is more primary than absolute population,
mm-hmm.
frankly.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we were very interested in was to understand the growth of cities.
After a short break, we'll return to our conversation with Dr. Jeffrey West, president of the Santa Fe Institute, and we'll talk to Denise Nunez about her recent experiences as a volunteer in New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward. But first, Planet is an assistant editor, Nate Berg, on the latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development.
Census population figures have come out for 2006, and one county is not very happy about it. Officials in Hamilton County, Ohio, are gathering support amongst their 49 concerned municipalities to submit a formal challenge against the U.S. Census Bureau's population estimates. Cincinnati and other Hamilton cities are upset over what they see as lowball estimates and are issuing their challenges in an effort to protect any federal grants they might lose because of their officially changing demographics. The Cincinnati Inquirer reports that Cincinnati successfully challenged the Bureau in 2005, and even though the 2006 figures show a population increase, the city says the numbers are still too low. If enough support is built among Hamilton County officials, theirs could be the first regional challenge to census data in history. Meanwhile, in New Jersey, the state superior court has put an end to a plan for a major downtown redevelopment in Newark, citing that the city had abused its eminent domain powers in condemning the property. The New York Times reports that the judge ruled against the city because it had inappropriately designated more than 60 parcels of land as blighted and in need of redevelopment. In addition, the judge called up documents from 2002 that proved the city had basically set plans for the redevelopment in stone, before even beginning the process of determining whether it could declare the land blighted. This ruling reinforces a state Supreme Court decision from June that places further limits on the use of eminent domain by cities. The disappointed developers of the project are calling the decision an end to urban redevelopment in the state of New Jersey. And finally, a trend being seen across the globe is picking up pace in the U.S. Fully automated garages are beginning to pop up in cities across America, from the nation's first in Hoboken, New Jersey, to a residential garage in Washington, D.C., and another in New York's Chinatown. The Wall Street Journal reports that developers are cozying up to the idea of integrating these robotic parking solutions into new projects, a technique that is helping to make the most use out of increasingly scarce land space. And as technology improves, the cost of building fully automated parking garages is beginning to seriously compete with traditional garage construction. Each space in a typical non-automated garage in New York City would run between $18,000 and $22,000. While each space in a fully automated garage ranged from $25,000 to $30,000. Developers' ears will obviously perk to that, but for now, car owners are less enthusiastic about handing over their babies to a gigantic parking robot. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of Planetizen. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. We're continuing our conversation with Dr. Jeffrey West, president of the Santa Fe Institute. Let me ask you two or three quick questions. You point out another phenomenon of cities, and you referred to it as you referred to patents. The more people cities have, the more productive each individual becomes. And you suggest that the reason that is the case is because cities tend to concentrate social interactions, and then that's what's needed for knowledge creation and innovation. Is that something you were studying more deeply? And I'm curious about the ways in which you would think about measuring those social interactions.
Yes, no, absolutely. That's very much one part of the next stage. Because it's very apparent, and I'm sure we're not the first to think of this, cities are the sort of magnets, or I like to think of them as sort of vacuum cleaners sucking up, sort of innovation and creativity from the rest of the the country or the area in which it's situated, and that is sort of in some sense the origin of part of the greater increase of innovation, creativity, and so forth per capita that exists in cities. And so understanding that dynamic is very important. And one of the projects that we will embark on is really trying to gather data that can help support that, some data we already have, but even some sort of simple exercises. Like, for example, I just throw this out. I mean, this may not prove to be successful. Is that taking a who's who and looking at where people live, which so these are highly successful people mm-hmm. since they've made it to who's who. Where do they live? Primarily, I'm sure one will find a predominance of major cities. That is, that most right. of them will be in cities, and compare that to where they were born and educated.
Interesting.
And my guess, this is totally intuitive, but it goes along with this kind of idea, is that when one find a much more uniform distribution of where people come from across, the United States in terms of their birthplace and place of education, you'll find them relatively uniformly distributed relative to the distribution of where they now live, indicating, this magnetic vacuum cleaner phenomenon that of cities. And the interesting thing, I think, one of the most interesting things, is, as I've already said, is that the quantitative representation of that magnetic effect of cities in terms of super creative people, colleges, patent production, in terms of those using those as metrics, is also reflected in a very, very similar way in terms of disease, crime, and so forth.
So you get the good with the bad?
So you get exactly. And these, and somehow you have to have a theory, a theory of social phenomena and social interaction that explains that. It explains that when you get greater creativity, greater wealth production, somehow coming along with that in this sort of average idealized case, you're going to inevitably get more crime and more disease. And I think that's quite fascinating. And to understand why that is the case at a deep level and to understand quantitative way, why it is the number I gave you, that if you increase by a factor of 100 the city, or a factor of 10, let's make it somewhat simpler. If you increase the city by a factor of 10, instead of getting 10 times the number of patents being produced, 10 times the number of crimes being created, 10 times the number of students and so on, you actually get 14 or 15 times. You get a greater increase. So to really understand that is important. Incidentally, one thing I did mean to mention that comes along with this, that is an integral part of the theory, even though it hasn't been completely developed, is that the question of pace of life in biology, I already emphasized that the increase in size and the economy of scale, one of the consequences of that that comes out of the theory is indeed a prediction for this slowing down of the pace of life. And the converse or the inverse occurs in social organizations. If you have this, if cities are driven primarily by this wealth creation of innovative kinds of phenomena, if that's what is a major thrust in the growth and functionality of a city, then inevitably going along with that is an increase of the pace of life in cities.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we looked at that was mentioned in the paper was this amusing phenomena that you walk faster in cities. Bank transactions go faster in cities. Spread of disease goes faster and so on.
Which is not what you would have expected by studying animals.
That's right, exactly. Quite contrary to animals. Animals behave exactly the converse. Everything would go slower. Rates would slow down. Times would take longer. You know, the bigger you are, you live longer and so on.
So it's the peculiar social nature
Yes.
of certain aspects of cities that
Yes.
cause them to behave very differently than
Yes.
you would expect by studying animals.
Yes, it is a reflection, a deep reflection of the kinds of interactions, the kinds of both one-on-one interactions that are fundamental to cities, but also the clusters of people that form groups, whether they be work groups, you know, small groups that occur in small businesses or small groups that occur within a big company, how those groups interact, how those conglomerations of groups interact with each other, that builds up to provide this phenomenon of greater creativity per capita and greater increase in the pace of life.
As president of Santa Fe Institute, what do you do to foster innovation? I mean, do you see evidence in your own work circumstance that social interaction indeed leads to innovation? And if so, how do you encourage that?
Yes, that's a very good question. The Santa Fe Institute, you know, is an institute that is quite unique, really, on the in the academic research community. Because it was set up and is dedicated to fostering cross-disciplinary, transdisciplinary kind of research on very much associated with complex systems such as cities or communities or financial markets or, you know, the global climate and so on. So it's these kinds of big questions that we concern ourselves with. And in terms of the way we deal with those and how to foster innovation is really very much this idea that if you bring interesting people together that have thought broadly about what they are working on, I mean their own specific kind of discipline or their own body of work, but they are very open to seeing how that may impact other things. So if you bring such people together and provide them with a free-flowing environment driven primarily by sort of bottom-up kinds of processing rather than top-down, if you bring such people together in an environment which encourages multiple interactions, then you can stimulate innovative, creative thinking across very broad spectrum of problems. And that's pretty much what SFI tries to do. And, you know, by bringing people together, we mean both at a very informal level, just have people hang out, bringing them together in small working groups of 10 or 15 with some idea in mind, some topic in mind, or bringing them in a slightly more formal way where you might have 30 to 35 people together, again, with maybe a very broad topic in mind, but also providing the environment where in which people feel very free to interact, whether they be a student, a young postdoctoral fellow, or a Nobel Prize winner, and providing that environment, meaning that two of the most important times at the Institute are lunch and tea time.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody gathers, and the kitchen is maybe the most important place in the whole institution, frankly, because that's where people informally gather and all sorts of interesting conversations take place, often very far-reaching. The Institute can really only accommodate maximally 50 to 60 people at any one time, and typically there's usually only 30 to 40, sometimes as small as 20. And we have no intention whatsoever of ever getting any bigger in terms of physical size, because it is crucial to maximize, how shall I say it, the sort of cross-sectional area of interaction. You know, you want to make sure that everybody on a daily basis in principle can interact with anyone else. And so that's really important, and it is really the essence of stimulating innovation. And incidentally, the Institute is really a visiting institution with a very large distributed network internationally. And so it has a great flux of people that are coming through on a regular basis, and we need to optimize the amount of interaction. So in that sense, it is doing what I believe it is trying to accomplish, what we have evolved in creating communities and cities, which are really places where individuals interact, both in terms of doing their sort of what might be called their mundane jobs of keeping the city functioning, but also in terms of being able to innovate, because they are really interacting in small units, often in close quarters. And I think one of the things that if you want to have more innovation in the city, you want to create more and more of those kinds of gathering places. And in some ways, you know, Starbucks discovered that.
Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Sure. Great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Dr. Jeffrey West is president of the Santa Fe Institute. You're listening to Smart City. Denise Nunez is just back from a trip to New Orleans, where she chaperoned 10 17-year-olds from Chicago to get houses in the Lower Ninth Ward. Denise is a Williams College graduate and a native of Evanston, Illinois. Denise, you recently took a group of Chicago-based high school age kids down to New Orleans to work on the demolition and rehabilitation of homes in New Orleans. Tell me about that experience. How did you get involved?
I actually have a friend who worked for a CDC in the Rogers Park area. Her name is Stacey Ehrenberg. And Stacey gave me a call one day and she said, Denise, I'm taking, 15 kids down to New Orleans, and I was wondering if you'd be willing to drive. And I had some free time on my hand, and I agreed to go along with them. So that's initially how I got involved. And as I thought about it more before I gave her my definite yes, I had never been to the South One, and my entire high school years were pretty much all about volunteering in third world countries and areas that needed the help the most. So it just seemed like the natural thing for me to do.
And when you got to New Orleans, what did you find?
First, it was extremely hot, which I was not used to. But then we actually drove through the Lower Ninth Ward upon arriving to New Orleans, and it looked like a complete ghost town. I was shocked. It was really moving, actually, to go down there and see that, almost 2 years post-Katrina, things still weren't really where they needed to be.
You worked there how long?
We were there for a week and a half, almost 2 weeks, and we worked with the People's Organizing Committee while we were down there.
Tell me about the People's Organizing Committee.
The People's Organizing Committee is a community-led group, and so they get funding from various sources, but all the funding decisions are made by people within the community, people who were affected by Hurricane Katrina. So they have a Survivors Council Advisory Board comprised of people who were hit by Katrina. And that was really great. We really liked that idea because we wanted to work with people who were actually deciding what happened to their homes themselves.
Tell me about the actual work that you did with the high schoolers.
The work that we did with the high schoolers, it varied. The People's Organizing Committee, they're very organized, believe it or not. And so they had the students doing various things while they were down there. So the day we got down there, we had a briefing session, and it was explained to the kids that we would be going into homes and completely gutting them. So taking out everything in homes from walls to fixtures, everything, and just leaving the frame pretty much, because one of the laws states that you need to gut your house if there's any damage from the water. And then every evening that we were there, the kids actually went out into the community to solicit more people to join the Survivors Council, which was really great. I think really, for some, it was kind of daunting to actually be face-to-face with people who were affected by Katrina and going door-to-door, talking to them about their personal stories and really trying to get them engaged and get them more involved with what was going on in their community.
Did you find people willing to participate?
Yes and no. Yes, I guess everybody's response kind of, it seemed like you were of one of two minds. Either you were really excited to help out or kind of fed up with the lack of support that was coming. And what we noticed was that as far as demographics are concerned, the People's Organizing Committee happens to be an organization that whose membership is mostly comprised of older people. So I'd say 40s to 60s are most of the members, and we didn't see enough young people out there. That really bothered us. So it was kind of the kids' goals to get out there and talk to people who were more along their age and get them interested and involved in the projects.
Did they have any success?
You know, we got people to sign up and give phone numbers, but I actually, one of the activities that I did while the kids were out going door to door was actually the phone banking. So I made the phone calls to people, inviting them out to different meetings and workshops and the such. And it remained, our main demographic happened to be the 40 to 60 year olds. We didn't really get the younger folks out. So we brainstormed with them some possible approaches to getting younger people interested and involved.
I'd be curious about what you thought some of those approaches might be. What did you think would be more successful, work better with getting young people out?
Well, in an area like the Lower Ninth Ward, there are no people because there are no jobs, because there are no schools, but one doesn't necessarily, you know, precede the other. They're all very much interconnected and interrelated. So one of the program coordinators actually thought that it would be a really great idea to get funding and actually pay kids, give them an opportunity to make money by helping rebuild other people's homes. So basically how that would work is there'd be funding, the kids would work gutting houses, that would be their job, and they'd get paid to do it. It'd be getting them into the community, but also offering them some source of income, because a lot of people there are no jobs, and there's just no way to make money.
Is it something you would do again?
Actually, I called my mom, and I said, Mom, I'm not coming home. And she was like, Denise, pack your stuff and come home. And I actually fell in love with the work that was going on down there. It's not just a struggle for people on the local level. It's not just people who are displaced because of Katrina. It's also people who are being exploited from other countries. People are coming on visas that don't actually turn out to be legit when they get here, or they get here on legit visas and don't have work. So there's a lot of need for support down there, and I really felt like I could play a huge role. I don't really know where my future is going to take me, but hopefully it'll be back down to New Orleans.
Did you, on the way back with the kids, did you notice that there were any changes in them? How did the experience affect them?
That was probably the best part of the experience for me. I went, you know, with a really open mind because I didn't know these kids. I didn't know what to expect. And they blew me away. They were extremely receptive the whole time we were down there. They were thoughtful. They were respectful. They just respected everybody and everything about the culture down there, and I was just so, so proud of them. In our debriefing session, we actually had the quietest of the bunch is the person who probably took the most from the experience. She started talking about, you know, what she really enjoyed and, like, broke down in tears. And that's kind of, like, when we all noticed how much more of an impact that area, like, post-Katrina New Orleans had on us than we could ever have on it by just simply gutting houses and talking to people. So the kids came back. A lot of them really want to continue to be involved with People's Organizing Committee and other organizations down there.
There's an article in this week's Time magazine about volunteer vacations, and it asks what I think is a legitimate question, and that is, does the work matter that's done on volunteer vacations? Are people going and doing rework? Is it something to, you know, pay your money and assuage your guilt by going down and working, but in fact, what they really need is money to use in better and more productive ways. In assessing your experience in New Orleans, do you think your investment of time was a better investment than one of money?
It's a great question and a really, really hard question to answer. I think whatever motivates you, you should go with it and let it lead you to where it leads you. After being down there, I don't really care why people are down there or if they paid money to go down there, because I do think the work is really important. I would never say that because I went down for free. It was more important of an experience than someone who paid. You know, however people get down there, I'm really in support of the fact that they're down there helping. So we met a lot of people who were down there on volunteer vacation trips, and they cared just as much as we do, I think.
What is the philosophy behind the People's Organizing Committee? You said that it's really looking at work by the people, for the people, in effect. Do you think there's something special about their philosophy that makes them more or less successful and effective in the community than other organizations?
They probably would get a little bit more street credibility because it's comprised of people from the community. So that would probably be the first benefit. But the whole for the people, by the people thing is really important because when I was down there, it seemed like the general feeling was that people really didn't care about Black people in New Orleans or in America in general. And that if anything was going to happen, it was something that we as a group needed to be spearheading. And we needed to not be depending on other people to help us anymore. And I say us because I'm Black and I identify as an African-American woman and felt very much like I'm part of that struggle, too. Even though I'm from the North, I'd never been to the South before my trip to Katrina. I mean, to New Orleans, I'm sorry. But I really identified with that. And in situations like that, you really need to find a way to empower people to action. It's too easy to become complacent when things aren't really manifesting themselves the way you'd like them to.
Denise Nunez recently returned to Chicago from volunteering in New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith shares his feelings on the necessity of war.
War is a dirty business. I've been reading about it lately in Roy Blunt Jr.'s short biography of Robert E. Lee. Behind the shimmering facade of honor and glory were the sordid, unsanitary, chaotic lives of ordinary soldiers. Rations in the Civil War were spotty. Shoes were a luxury. Soldiers spent cold, wet nights in the open air, spooning together for warmth and cover. Disease was the biggest killer of the Civil War, accounting for 3/4 of Union deaths and 2/3 of Confederate deaths. Half of these deaths were caused by diarrhea, dysentery, and typhoid fever, not to mention periodic outbreaks of measles, mumps, and chickenpox. Pneumonia was the 3rd leading killer disease of the war. 9 in 10 soldiers on both sides contracted chronic diarrhea or dysentery. This is no surprise given the foul conditions of camp life in which soldiers lived amidst decomposing piles of slop, refuse, manure, and offal, often adjacent to stagnant water teeming with malarial mosquitoes. In many ways, the battlefield was actually a safer place to be. Of course, woe was the fate of the soldier wounded in battle. The musket ball of the Mexican War a few decades earlier had been replaced by a high-caliber conical bullet that ripped through flesh and bone with a destructive force greater than the bullets used 50 years later during World War I. Transport from the battlefield to a field hospital was often by mule-drawn carts without springs over rutted and rocky dirt roads. Many wounded were said to have cried out to be left to die rather than to be carried further in these wagons. Surgeons had minimal training, and for want of water and understanding, their instruments, badges, uniforms, and hands went unwashed. Gangrene, staph, and strep were rampant. The only glory in the Civil War is in the retelling. And even then, we Southerners must use some sleight of hand about the dubious moral and constitutional principles that stirred the Confederacy. Our thinking in general about wars is like this. We prefer to envision them as clean affairs, undertaken as a last resort, and fought with a clear moral conscience on the side of goodness and light. We glorify war too much, to the point that we are shaken, even scandalized, by the opening 24 minutes of Steven Spielberg's movie Saving Private Ryan. Yet even that gore is a mild dose of real war. But it shocks us by comparison to the bloodless John Wayne action flicks we grew up with. Sometimes wars must be fought. But most times, wars are terrible, pointless endeavors that compromise our highest values and accomplish little but embittering our enemies and further entrenching the hatreds that spurred the conflict in the first place. If America, the greatest home of freedom in the history of the world, can't rise above this, then we must resign ourselves to an eternity of carnage and destruction. But I believe we are better than that. I believe we are smart enough, brave enough, and rich enough to lead without resorting to the use of force that ensnares us in a terrible web of peril and ruin. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders who just released the new report, Kids in Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.